This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Fire up the DeLorean. We're going back in time. The History of WWE.com proudly presents the History of Wrestling podcast right here on Place to Be Nation.
Everybody, this is Graham Coffin of the History of WWE.com coming back to you again this week with the History of Wrestling podcast from the Place to Be Nation. Very glad to be back. We've been off for a couple weeks now. We had Snowmageddon hit the entire country, but we're still alive. And we've got a fun show here lined up today. Brad's here, Dan's here, and Scott Hudson is here. Guys, how are you?
Absolutely wonderful. Glad to be back and absolutely thrilled to have Scott here with us. And we're going to dig deep into some of the magic and some of the hidden gems, you might say, of the classic WCW television shows. So it's going to be a fun conversation.
Scott, we have not talked in a while, but we actually go back quite a ways to Monday Night Mayhem back almost a good long while ago. How are you doing right now?
I'm doing fantastic, Graham. It's great to talk to you again. It's been a couple of years since the Mayhem piled it in, but that was a good run. I had a blast doing that show. It was always great seeing you. Saw you down here at Mania, and your lovely wife, although she wasn't, I don't think she was your wife at the time, but she's your wife now.
Right. I got her drunk after the fact, and she agreed.
Interesting.
That's how all my marriages
started.
Well, I remember we had lunch before the Rumble, or at dinner before the Rumble there in Atlanta a few years ago. How was the weather in Atlanta?
Good grief. I think I said Mania, by the way. It was Rumble. Tonight it's supposed to be like wind chills of negative 2-3 degrees tomorrow morning. This is in Atlanta, Georgia. You know, and it's going to be like negative 2 tomorrow morning. It's ridiculous.
For some comparison, how's New England doing right now?
Well, you know, I woke up to a balmy 8 degrees this morning, and that was great. And I think it's going to dip to about minus 17 tonight. And I might be exaggerating, but it was snowing when I got home from the office today, which is not uncommon. I think we've had something in the neighborhood of 90 inches in the last 4 weeks. So, you know, that's nothing to sneeze at.
And then Brad and I here in North Carolina have about an inch of quote unquote wintry mix.
Yeah. I'm wearing shorts right now, guys. It's nice. I like it.
Well, Brad,
I'm going down to the Daytona 500 next weekend, or this coming weekend, and it's supposed to be 77 degrees in Daytona. The guys
nice.
I'm going with are like, yeah, it's going to be shorts weather. Like, yeah, hell yeah, let's go.
Get the hell out of that wintry wonderland.
Well, Brad hinted at it a few minutes ago, but the topic that we're going to be talking about tonight is something that kind of occurred to me about a month or 6 weeks ago. I've kind of fallen into a vortex, like a twilight zone, of weird WCW B-level or C-level, and we'll explain exactly what that means, television from like the late 90s. Because it's, I think at that time when that was going on live, I really wasn't interested in these shows, so I didn't watch them at all. Because everything at that point was happening on Nitro, it was happening on Thunder, and then WCW Saturday Night, once Thunder came around, and that's actually, Scott, when you joined the broadcast team on Saturday Night, was in many cases a showcase for the likes of Greg Valentine, Silver King, La Parca, and it ran the gamut talent wise, but you knew that you could reasonably skip Worldwide and Saturday Night and Main Event at that point, because nothing happened that was so big that it would ever be mentioned on Nitro or Thunder.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that did change after a while when, and I don't want to get too far ahead of the game here, but they brought in Jimmy Hart as ostensibly the booker of WCW Saturday Night, and Jimmy's ideas were basically to undo what you said, that, you know, Saturday Night was where, and, you know, it got, guys got work, guys got to, you know, play out stuff on TV, you know, work out new characters, that sort of thing, and because our ratings were, you know, we were doing like 2.5 for Saturday Night, which now would be fantastic, would double or better what TNA does, but, you know, that was at the time, like, okay, yeah, but it's not losing money, let's just keep it on. But Jimmy came in like, no, we should be doing stuff on this show, and they said, and they being, I guess, Vince and Ed and Bill Banks and that crowd, and Eric, to a degree, were like, yeah, do what you want. Just, you know, don't embarrass the company, and we're not going to follow up on your angles on Nitro or Thunder, but have fun. And that's what we did, and we did all kind of crazy stuff on Saturday Night. It was a blast.
Well, let's create a little context, Graham, for someone who maybe is a younger fan or doesn't quite understand what we're talking about. Back in the 80s and the early 90s, and even into the 90s, you know, WCW on TBS, it was the 605 show was enormous. The Saturday Night 605 show was enormous. With the rise in popularity of Nitro and eventually Thunder, what was the flagship show, Dusty Rhodes would always call it the mothership show, was kind of pushed down a peg. And to Scott's point, it's where a lot of veteran guys would get work. And you'd also see, like Scott said, you'd see guys like Devin Storm show up there before he was hired back on as Crowbar and things like that. But with all that, with the 605 show kind of going down a peg, it sent the syndicated TV shows Worldwide and WCW Pro, which were also major shows in the 80s, it sent them down a peg as well. And kind of to Graham's point, there wasn't a lot of major storyline intensive stuff happening there. You didn't get a lot of the main angles represented. But if you go back and watch them now, it's a lot of guys that you never knew wrestled each other, and a lot of things that maybe you don't remember happening. And to Graham's point, as he can attest to, you really can, if you start searching, kind of go down the rabbit hole and end up watching weeks and weeks and weeks of this TV, because it's simple, it's easy to digest, and it's very much in the vein of like an older school 80s style wrestling program, Graham.
And very and very well announced, I might add.
Yes, it was.
Very well
announced.
Yes,
they were. Well, it's also kind of addictive because, like you said, you're always going to see something weird in there, weird in today's context. You're not supposed to ever see Randy Savage against the Ultimo Dragon. And then the fact that it goes 2 minutes, it makes your eyes bulge out even more. Going back to what Brad said about Worldwide, especially, I failed to make this point earlier on. Worldwide, I would argue back in the 80s, was even better than the 605 from a I think an angle standpoint, and probably, yes, even definitely from a wrestling standpoint. Worldwide, you would often see name versus name matches. 605, it was very heavy on the interviews, very heavy on the squashes, but they hyped every conceivable upcoming house show that you could ever think of. But on Worldwide, you would see title changes, which we'll get into later. You would see feud start, and you would see it very much kind of had the Raw feeling,
Point. That Worldwide show, well, you know, with the TBS Saturday Night show back in the day, was filmed in that little tiny studio there on Techwood Drive in Midtown Atlanta. And what you see on those shows back in the days before the center stage tapings, that was the entire studio. It wasn't like there was an awful lot of room behind the camera. The camera was against the wall, and that was everything there was. And the dressing rooms were like the offices of some of the muckety mucks at Turner Broadcasting. I mean, there was nothing to it. It was tiny. But those worldwide shows were taped in pretty much every high school gym in North Carolina, and they had a rabid crowd, and they would have, you know, 1,000, 1,500 people in those high school gyms, and they were crazy loud, and everybody was so over. So it did have more of like an old-school Raw, like from the Manhattan Center kind of feel to it, just because there were more people. I mean, God, there couldn't have been 40 people in those TBS studio shows. I wonder if a few of those drove up from South Georgia to watch them, and there's just like nobody there. But it was full.
Yeah, well, I definitely agree with that. I definitely agree with Graham's point on that. It definitely was, to me, the worldwide show in particular in the 80s, it felt tighter. It felt like there was hardly a minute of airtime that wasn't treated as important, and it wasn't devoted to getting somebody over or something over. It felt like something was happening all the time. It was a really tightly produced 60-minute show. The 605 show, where sometimes you had 90 minutes or 2 hours, or, you know, kind of depending on when the Braves were playing, but the 605 show, it felt like a little more padded, a little more, you know, just go out there and do 10 minutes. And I agree. I think for my money, the worldwide show, especially in the 80s and even up until about maybe 92 or 93, I'll put that up as maybe the best show of the WCW regime for its time. It was a tight, exciting hour for all the reasons that everybody's mentioned.
So, Scott, take us back to like late 97, early 98. I've been watching some Saturday Night here lately, and I noticed that you and Mike Tenay take over the commentary team right after Sold Out. So it's right after Dusty Rhodes joins the NWO, and then without any real announcement or anything, he and Tony Schiavone are off that show, and it's you and Mike Tenay. How did that happen?
Well, yeah, I had been there for a couple of years, I guess, doing pro and worldwide and every, you know, international show, it seemed like, just everything except what you could watch on Nitro or Thunder. Well, Thunder wasn't around then, but on Nitro or Saturday Night. So one day out of nowhere, I get this call at my house from Eric, and says, I got a proposal for you. I want to see if you want to do that. I said, sure, whatever. What do you want to do? And he said, we want to put you on Saturday Night. And I didn't know what he meant. I mean, it didn't cross my mind that he meant WCW Saturday Night. I thought he meant he wanted to put me on, like, doing backstage interviews or hosting some kind of news segment or something like that. And I said, sure, whatever you want to do. What's the story? And he said that it's going to be me. It's going to be you. It's going to be Gordon Sully, then Tony, then you. That's it. And of course, my jaw dropped. And if you're serious, I'll do it. I'll, you know, when do I start? Where do I go? And that was, I mean, I just found out, I think probably something like Monday before we taped the show on Friday was about all the notice I had. I didn't get like months and months to prepare for that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, showed up at the WCW studios, and we were ready to go. I mean, there was all post-produced. You know, there was no studio at the time. We were just tossing the matches from other locales where it had been taped. We were never there live. We were always in front of a set and in the studio calling the VO as a play-by-play. It was supposed to sound like we were there live. We weren't ever, actually. But that, you know, I got about, like I said, about 4 days' notice, and off we went. Mike and I knew each other, and so we had, you know, liked each other and clowned around, and so we had a great chemistry. But that was it. We just got a couple of days' notice, and off we go.
Well, I was about to ask about whether you guys were ever there, because I was watching an episode earlier today, because this is what I do, and you name drop. You're pretty good about name dropping the arena where it's being taped, almost to the degree of, you know, they're 5 feet away from me here at the Manatee Civic Center in Palmetto, Florida.
Right.
So I thought that was a nice touch.
Well, we did our homework, and that was what Eric wanted. He wanted it to at least feel like we were there. And so, we would find out from the crew. It was easy to do. It was all over the the billboards of the on the recording of the matches, where they were, the date they were there, you know, the name of the building. So that part was pretty easy. So it's just being a professional, I guess, to say that kind of thing and to make people feel like it's there. It's one of the answers, one of the thousands of answers to the questions about, oh, they really don't hit each other, so wrestling's a work. I'm like, you have no idea about how much of a work wrestling is. Actually, the hitting part is way more real than most everything else. That's the kind of stuff that's a work that nobody even realizes.
Yeah, I think it's a testament to the power of that show that even in, you know, the late 90s when, like Graham and I had touched on, it was no longer really thought of as the main show anymore. You know, Nitro had been on the air for, a year, almost 2 years at that point. But I think it's really a testament to the power of that 605 show. How much it meant to you to get that call and be like, you know, holy crap, I'm gonna anchor the 605. Like, that was the 605 show. To try and put it in context for some younger, you know, listeners, that 605 show on WTBS, and Scott, by all means, you can attest to this, that was the show in the 80s and beyond, as far as really one of the first shows to really reach a wide audience on cable.
Well, I am 50 years old, and I started watching wrestling in 1970 when I was about four and a half years old, if that tells you anything. Four and a half years old, I guess. And I was insanely in love with the sport from then forward. And the TBS show, it was WTCG, Channel 17 out of Atlanta back at the time, and that Saturday night show at 6 o'clock, and the 6:05 thing came in like the early 80s. Ted Turner wanted to, you know, give everybody 5 minutes to watch something else and then turn over and catch all of his show. That was the marketing gimmick. But that show started in the early 70s, 72, 73, something like that. Otherwise, there was, you know, just Georgia Championship was kind of a hit or miss. It was on four or five different stations around Atlanta, it seemed like, at the time. But when it hit on TBS, or TCG back then, I watched it. So I guarantee you I watched one of the first five shows, and I may have watched the first show for all I know, but I've watched that show my entire life and watched religiously from 1 hour to 2 hours to the 05s to the, you know, the Braves game delay time and on, just through everything. So yeah, it was an incredible honor for me to be on that show in any context, because it had been what raised me in the sport, you know. And then eventually we got to see, you know, from where I live down in South Georgia, I got to see Florida, the Gulf Coast territory out of Alabama, and then Mid-Atlantic. So I got to see everything, but it still all started and all had its genesis in that Georgia Championship Saturday night show. So it my heart just sang when Eric gave me that call. I was not going to screw it up.
I want to get Dan in the conversation because, you know, we're all from the South and kind of grew up on that Crockett Promotions era. Dan, a little bit younger and from the North, didn't start watching wrestling regularly until the late 80s. When did you first kind of get the significance of, let's say, the 605 show, like growing up, where you grew up in a different part of the country and kind of coming along for the ride of like Nitro and what you might call the Monday night boom? Was the 605 show really on your radar by the time you started watching, Dan?
Not necessarily, and not because it wasn't anything that I didn't have access to. Like, I didn't have, you know, the Turner Broadcasting networks. It was just one of those. If I was going to watch something, I knew there was more familiar names and faces. Now, I was maybe a little bit different than most folk up here because, you know, every now and again I would pick up a magazine, I'd pick up something where I'd read results and like, oh, there's another world out there besides what's going on Superstars of Wrestling and Wrestling Challenge and then the occasional primetime on USA. But eventually, once I started to kind of branch out and realize there's another world out there, you know, there's guys named Flair and Sting, and oh, they have painted guys too, and you start to branch out, and it's like, so I had my fix in the morning on a Saturday where I'd watch the syndicated WWE F programmings at the time. And then, wait, you're telling me on a different channel there's more wrestling? Like, okay. So I did kind of, as a passive observer, was able to dig in and, wow, okay, I can continue to feed my wrestling fix deep into the night on a Saturday. That's great. But it certainly wasn't appointment television right away. I would say that maybe if I started to watch any of those, particularly the Saturday night show, it was probably 91. And then it was probably because I had probably read up a little bit more on some of the other players in the game.
It was a real genesis for that show then, too, with the Dangerous Alliance and everything that was going on there. Like those syndicated shows and the Saturday night show stayed really, really strong well into the 90s. And Graham, I know you've been going back and watching a lot of them lately. You can attest to that.
Well, I'm actually going to throw myself under the car right now, because I started watching Saturday Night after Dan. I didn't get into wrestling until after Dan. And I've had this conversation with probably a few of you guys at this point, but I was a military kid and we moved around so much. We were in Germany until 88, and I didn't realize until years later that we actually did. And this is something that I would love to dig up more on in the future. In Germany, in the 80s, on the Armed Forces Network, we had access to WWF Superstars. We had access to Saturday Night's Main Event. And I remember on Christmas night, 1987, we had a back-to-back showing of Star Wars and the first Survivor Series.
That's awesome.
And it was on... It was essentially on free television, too. And so I would love to eventually start doing some digging about how Vince was smart. And I know this is going off our topic for the day, but how Vince was smart enough to market his product through the military to be shown around the world when, you know, Crockett was worried about, you know, taking Florida or taking Mid-South. And meanwhile, all these military guys are coming back home going, oh, I love wrestling now. What channel is it on in the States?
Yeah, so that's a great point. A topic that's never really been explored.
Right. And in talking with some international fans on Facebook, it did seem like it was pretty common to get the pay-per-view a month later for free. But to get back on topic, I don't think I started watching Saturday Night until 93. And I think my main hook then was I would go to Blockbuster all the time and just watch everything that they had. And so I knew some older WWF names. But once the British Bulldog showed up on Saturday night, I was like, that's my guy. That's like SummerSlam 92 is one of my favorite shows ever, if not my favorite show ever. And so that got me watching him chasing Vader for the titles, got me watching. And really in 93, I would say Saturday night easily trumped worldwide for being the show. In the 80s, it was a little hit or miss, but I think certainly by 93.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think maybe like around 89 or so was when, at least for a generation of 30s, the people that are in their 30s now, I think around 89 or so was when the 605 show really kind of took on a life of its own, from where, okay, the angles would happen there in the 80s, and you know, you would hear about things every now and then, to the point of it then became more of a must-see kind of show, and more where you know, really anything could happen, you know, the great Muda showing up and all that.
I'll tell you why you're right. You're exactly right about that, because it was in 89, I think it was in January, where Eddie Gilbert, and as we take this podcast, it's the 20th anniversary of Eddie's passing. Eddie was one of my best friends and my hero in the sport from way back, and I miss that guy terribly. But Eddie was on the show and was going to face, can't remember who it was, I think it was Barry Windham and somebody else, or some horseman representative tag team, and he had a mystery partner. And the mystery partner ended up being Rick Steamboat. And Steamboat comes out, and Eddie and Rick Steamboat beat a couple of the horsemen, and then off we go with Flair versus Steamboat, which took everything through the summer. And the summer is when it moved from the TBS studios to center stage. And also during the summer is when they transitioned from Steamboat Flair to Flair Funk, And then that took them through the rest of 1989. By this time, center stage tapings were all the rage in Atlanta, and you couldn't find a seat in the place, and the ratings were doing great. But that 1989 year, that was bookended by Flair Steamboat and then ended with Flair Funk, and also transitioned from TBS to center stage for a taping location. That was the seminal year for that program. It really went through the roof in 89.
Yeah, if you look back now and even go through the tapes of whatever, it's Eddie Gilbert against Barry Windham, and then the following week it's Gilbert and a partner against Flair and Windham, and it's
right.
Two of the back-to-back best matches in the history of wrestling on WTBS. Like, it really was the benchmark, and with everything, I'm glad you brought up Eddie, because it really maybe gets us a little bit off topic, but not really, because he brought so much excitement to those shows. You know, he threw the fireball at Muta, and Muta ducked, and he ended up burning Cougar Jay, and just Gary Hart and Missy Hyatt, and just all these interesting new characters. And that was kind of you know, Sting had worked with Flair in 88 at the Clash of the Champions, but 89 as the television champion and wrestling with Muta was kind of when Sting was really starting to rise to prominence. There were so many exciting elements that were introduced. First, we saw of Rick Steiner's brother Scott. First, we saw the Steiner brothers as a team. Just so many exciting elements that got introduced. Scott, to your knowledge, you know, what was the mentality of the powers that be towards, let's say, WCW Saturday Night or even the syndicated shows once Nitro took off? You touched on it a little bit earlier about, you know, just don't embarrass us out there and do what you want. But did they feel like it was still a worthwhile property or more of an afterthought once Nitro had really gotten hot?
Right, yeah. To put it in current connotation, it was NXT. That's what Saturday Night was, with the added sprinkling, if you will, of the veteran names to come in to try to keep the ratings up, or to keep the ratings up, because the ratings were fine. It was basically a place to let some of the guys that were not going to get pushed on Nitro have a push, to give names that, you know, could bring in a rating even if they weren't in an angle, too. And most importantly, third, to give new guys a place to work and work out the kinks and work out not so much new characters, but work out new styles and new moves. And, you know, when things were running hot and heavy, even Saturday night tapings, and we had, you know, tapings for just the Saturday night show, they were selling out, mm-hmm. not papered or anything. You would sell 3,000 tickets for a Saturday night taping. Wasn't on Saturday night, obviously, but wherever it was, they would sell out. And that's how hot WCW was at the time. And there was an awful lot of high voltage matches, and, you know, a lot of Tough Tom and Mean Mike, whatever their names were. I can't remember.
Disorderly Conduct.
Disorderly Conduct. Thank you. You know, there were a lot of those guys. And then there was an awful lot of, you know, Chris Adams. There was a lot of Greg Valentine. There was a few Marty Jannetty sightings. In all of this, there was some Mikeyness and Wayne Bloom, and a lot of those guys that were just terrific hands and good wrestlers and knew what they were doing, but just not in line for a push, showed up on Saturday night.
Yeah, I think great hands is exactly the right way to put it. It's for me, that was part of the fun of watching those shows, was to see guys like a Bobby Eaton or a Chris Adams or whoever that, you know, they weren't getting that much. They'd pop up on Nitro occasionally, but it was more fun to see them get, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 minutes on Saturday night, because to Scott's point, you know, people my age and older knew those guys. They knew Chris Adams from World Class and from the UWF and from all the places that he'd been, and they knew Bobby Eaton from, you know, the Midnight Express. So for people my age and older, it was a reason to tune in.
Well, the another aspect of it, you're exactly right, and the way that played into it was that WCW, you know, the hierarchy, you know, Eric and Vince and all those guys, they knew that everybody that watched Saturday Night was going to watch Nitro, period. That was not an issue, but it wasn't vice versa. Everybody watching Nitro was not going to watch Saturday Night, So when the crowd that watched the Saturday Night Show would watch Nitro, they would say, hey, there's the guy from Saturday Night. There's the guy from Saturday Night. There's the guy from Saturday Night. People that only watch Nitro go, who is this new guy? And it just kept interest. It kept questions being asked. And I can vividly remember that was Terry Taylor's only direction to me, you know, when I had him in my ear doing Nitro. And if I heard it once, I heard it about 50,000 times a night, was ask the question, ask the question, ask the question. And that type of booking allowed the fans to ask the question themselves without us asking it for them. Now, who is this guy? Where can I see more of him? Like, I've never heard of Bill Gold, you know, which was Goldberg's name, and I think he worked more than a few Saturday night tapings as Bill Gold before he had the whole Goldberg character.
So up till this point, we've been talking about Saturday Night a lot. Talk to us a little bit about Worldwide and how that structure was a little bit different, or if it was different at all.
Worldwide, for the most part, by the time I got there, was being recorded in Orlando at the MGM Studios, which is sort of part of the Disney crowd down there. They had a little studio set up, and they would record, my God, and this isn't an overstatement, they would record 3 months of TV in 2 days. And it would just be one match after another. Match, 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 match. And they would all be 2, 3, 4 minutes each, and they'd run them out there, get to a finish, run them back, and bring out the next two guys. And the crowd, for the most part, they weren't part of the cast. There were people that showed up. It was a free show. It was just part of the, you know, part of the gig. If you showed up at the amusement park, you could come in and watch wrestling. And then we would do the wraparounds in the studio in Atlanta, and then some of the wraparounds we would be tossing to a match from Nitro or Thunder to further the main angles, and then we'd go back. And now here's this early conduct in their grudge match against High Voltage. And that's all we would get. That was the exclusive, the Worldwide exclusive.
The reason I ask is, and certainly when Worldwide was at that point, we were getting some kind of crazy stuff, like we would see a young AJ Styles, we would see a young Christopher Daniels. A few years earlier, and what I've been kind of stuck on here lately is actually right around the time that Nitro gets big. So this would have been like early 96. And Worldwide is putting on some crazy stuff week after week. I saw a match with Hogan and Shark that goes all – and I know that on paper is not that appealing for a lot of folks, but it goes less than 3 minutes, and Hogan throws everything at him except maybe pulls out a gun and shoots him. He hits him with a chair right in front of the referee. He throws the referee around. I mean, Hogan could have been disqualified 8 times, and he just mauls Shark. It's hilarious. It's like Shark owed him money. They would put out matches like the Steiners against Sting and Luger for the tag team titles, which was a match of the year in 1991, and they would have it go, you know, 5 minutes, and it wouldn't mean anything, and it would have some DQ ending. Some weird stuff that I came across, and it would make sense if the timing was a little bit different, but randomly, in the spring of 96, there's this huge contingent from New Japan that shows up. And right. had it been closer to Starrcade, it would have made more sense with the World Cup. But there's one show in particular that has Shono and Kintsugi Sasaki against the Nasty Boys. And then I know that's just weird. That should not happen anywhere in any time. And then a few weeks later, it's Diamond Dallas Page. And he was essentially coming off that homeless angle, cleanly pinning Kintsugi Sasaki with the diamond cutter.
Wow.
It's a very eclectic mix.
WCW is bringing in international guys left and right. I mean, we had, you know, the New Japan guys coming in. We had, good grief, I don't see how Triple H stayed in business. We had every luchador, it seemed, you know, that there was coming in and out of that place for the longest time. We had guys from, oh man, I can't even remember the names. We had Frank Anderson, I think his name was a German guy.
Yeah.
That came in, and you know, we just had this international player, and that was what they wanted, because we had such a huge international syndicated market that we could bring in those guys. And for whatever reason, back in the mid to late 90s, the guys from Mexico were known in Europe. The guys from Japan were known in Europe, but the guys in America weren't that well known if they weren't WWF talent. So if we brought in Masa Chono, that would mean something to the European market if we had him on the syndicated show. Where in America, it was like, it meant a lot to me, because I know who he was, but most everybody was like, oh, it's just another Japanese wrestler. He's pretty good. He looks pretty tough. Next. And that's what they would say. He wasn't, that over. I thought he was fantastic, but it did mean something when we could package him in part of the international syndicated broadcast, and those ratings always did fine. I'll be honest with you. Here in 2015, I still hear mostly via social media from fans in Europe, and this is, pushing 20 years ago, that will still talk about the syndicated WCW product from Europe, where nobody even remembers it in America. Over there, it's still a big deal because they liked it so much because of the international flavor we had.
Because of these worldwide.
That's a really good point. I never knew that. That's something I never considered, and it's interesting because if you look at a match listing for say a year of worldwide, the most eclectic group of people you can ever imagine are going to show up: Jushin Thunder Liger and the Armstrongs and the Rock and Roll Express and a German wrestler, a Swedish wrestler, and Doc Dean and Robbie Brookside from England.
I remember them. Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely, the most eclectic group. And to me personally, and I think people my age, that was kind of the fun. I touched on a little while ago that you got to see Bobby Eaton and Chris Adams and people like that. But you also got to see, Benoit right as he was hitting his stride. You got to see Guerrero, and you got to see Juventud and all those guys. To Scott's point, not necessarily trying out new characters per se, but getting acclimated to the style. You would get them a lot of times first on those syndicated shows or on Saturday night, and I don't know. It was some of the most fun because you never, literally just coming back from commercial, you never knew who was going to pop up next. It could be Wayne Bloom and Mike Enos, or it could be Koji Kanemoto. There's never been a time in our business where one organization, one promotion, one group had a roster that deep and that varied that in a 1 hour show, you might get Doc and Gordy, you might get Jushin Liger, you might get the Rock and Roll Express, you might get, anybody. It's a time in our business that will never be recreated.
Brad, actually, one of the things that I noticed, even when watching kind of the late 90s editions, was you kind of scratch your head thinking, oh my gosh, that guy was still working at that point. Because if you only watched, like, Nitro or Thunder, you might not actually have realized that Barry Darso was still collecting a paycheck at the time, or
John Nord,
right? Yeah. It's funny. And then Scott, to your credit, like, you try to put over certain things. Like, I watched the match with that. Actually, I have a nice little buddy relationship with Scotty Riggs after he appeared on a show with me one time, and we still tweet back and forth. And I saw him, and at one point the announcer was like, and he's not wearing that eye patch anymore. And it's like, oh yeah, because anytime we used to see Scotty Riggs on the big show, he would be in the flock and he's wearing an eye patch, and now he actually looks like an American male again. So it was really kind of interesting to kind of look back, even in as late as like 97, 98, the exclusives on 99, and being like, oh, I didn't even realize he was still in the company at this point. And it kind of just shows to what your point was, Brad, earlier about the depth of the roster at the time.
Well, bringing it back to Saturday night, if I could, you brought Darso. And that was he's the prime example of what we did, because or what was trying to have been done there. And it was Jimmy's idea, was doing that hole-in-one gimmick where he showed up basically dressed up as Payne Stewart, as a bald powerlifting Payne Stewart playing golf in the ring before the match started. Which is one of the most hysterical things. I remember I was doing the show with Zabisco at the time. Larry and I did the show for, a couple of years it seemed like. And Larry's like this huge golfer, loves golf. All he talked about. And whenever we would do the show, they always made sure that we had a hole-in-one Darso match. That was his name, Barry Hole-in-One Darso. And Larry just loved that gimmick and put it over like crazy, and it never showed up anywhere except Saturday night. And the same gimmick we did with Duggan, with Jim Duggan, something had happened on Nitro where he had lost, like, not a loser leaves town, but a loser loses his job match or something like that, that somehow involved Scott Hall. I can't remember how it all went down, but he wasn't fired, obviously, so he kept working on Saturday night, but as the janitor of the building where we recorded Saturday night. And he found where Scott Hall, I think, had thrown away the old World Television Championship belts, and we did this angle where Duggan finds the belt, rediscovers his passion for the business, and comes out calling himself on Saturday night the World Television Champion. And we did that, you know, for 3 or 4 months. And it was just terrific. The crowd's always popular. It was a nice little angle. Went nowhere. Wasn't meant to go anywhere, but it kept the show interesting.
Well, I got to say, I had forgotten about that part, but in this time period in which the company basically owns or has contract with every living, breathing person on the planet that's a wrestler that's not under WWF contract, it would have been a prime opportunity to make Saturday Night and make Worldwide kind of its own show. So it's less of a Nitro Thunder recap and more of a self-contained, like the TV champion is their quote-unquote world champion, which is kind of what they did later on Saturday Night with Duggan. I thought it was great because it gave you a reason to tune in every week aside from who are they going to have on there. Because I think the big negative during this point is, yes, all these guys are wrestling and they're all winning matches, or John Nord got another win, or Greg Valentine got another win. But what is it leading to? Like, why? What's the point of – will they ever get a title match? No. But they just beat somebody.
Mm-hmm. That was kind of Jimmy Hart's vision for the show, wasn't it, Scott?
Well, I'm sorry.
That was kind of Jimmy Hart's vision for the show, wasn't it, Scott, to have its own little self-contained show?
Correct. That's exactly right. And I heard – and it was fleeting, and as in fleeting, I think I heard it for a week that it was being knocked around and possibly maybe getting ready to fixing to be discussed, as we would say in the South. And that was having a WCW Saturday Night pay-per-view, which would have been $9 or $9.99 to coin a phrase pay-per-view, where it would have been just the best of all the Saturday Night BS we were doing, with a couple of named guys or a couple of named matches on top. And, you know, that never went anywhere. But Eric and Vince to it later, and, you know, Kevin Sullivan and Terry and all the powers that be there thought enough of what we were doing to actually give that voice. It could have just been blowing sunshine off our skirt for the hell of it, and I forgot about it, and that's possible. But at least they thought enough about it to, you know, even to make that up, even if they weren't really considering it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of positives of these shows at the time because of the huge influx of talent and variety of talent. But I think the negative is, what are they fighting for?
Right.
And I think there's so many guys that get lost in the shuffle that they're just fighting for, you know, really no reason in the grand scheme of things.
Mm-hmm. That's true. And there came a point where WCW Saturday Night was not, I won't say not profitable. It was always profitable, but it got to be too much trouble for what it was worth. That, you know, booking that much talent and paying that much travel and just all the, you know, the infrastructure of moving that kind of talent around just to do a show that was just that much ahead of breaking even financially, and that's when they ended up just pulling the plug on it.
What do you remember about those last days, Scott, of the conversations? Did everyone pretty much know it was coming, or was it a surprise to hear that the plug had been pulled on the legendary 605 show?
Well, yeah, sort of. It was always thought that they would find a spot for us, but as the company moved away from being owned by Turner Broadcasting, and then it was owned by Turner and Time Warner. And the Time Warner people were great. They were interested in one thing, money. And if it made $3 profit every year, that was $3 more than they had, you know, go for it. That's perfect. But when we got toward the AOL merger, they started looking when they got to thinking about the AOL merger, they started looking at everything's bottom line. They being Turner and Time Warner, not Ted Turner, but the Turner Broadcasting people, and they saw that it just wasn't profitable enough. It wasn't generating enough ad revenue to justify its line item in the WCW budget. And this was still in the days where I can't remember exactly if we were still in the black when Saturday Night got canceled. My gut feeling is to say it was probably the first year that we went back into the red as a company, that they canceled Saturday Night. And that was probably, you know, that one cost, you know, a good bit of money to produce, even though it generated a good bit of money in ad revenue. But that was one of the first things that got the axe, and they started, you know, wielding that axe for budgetary reasons.
Well, I absolutely appreciate Scott being with us. We're going to take a break and hear from the other shows on the Place to Be Nation. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with more with Scott Hudson, more WCW syndicated shows, the crazy characters that showed up, the wacky things that happened and almost happened. We'll be back after this word from the other shows on the Place to Be Nation.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com. The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Hey, this is Bauer from The Bauer Show, sports and more. You can check out The Bauer Show podcast every Wednesday and Friday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
The Bauer Show.
Chad, do you hate it when commercials run and run?
What do you mean, Parv?
Oh, never mind.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play on PlaceToBeNation.com and find us on iTunes. We are the only WCW Supercard exclusive podcast.
Greetings, friends. Ben Morse from Place to Be Nation's Main Event here. Tired of other podcasts constantly stuck in the past? Every other week, we give you a roundtable discussion of what's happening in wrestling today. Place to Be Nation's Main Event. We're holding everybody else down.
Looking for something different in your pro wrestling podcasts? Look no further than the Pro Wrestling Super Show. Join me, Stephen Graham, every week as I'm joined by a rotating door of guests as we discuss a single topic each show, ranging from ECW pay-per-view reviews, wrestler snapshots, top six lists, and anything else you can think of. That's the Pro Wrestling Super Show every week here on the Place to Be Nation.
So you got the script, yeah? You all got it?
Yeah.
Oh, that sounds terrible. The Titans of Wrestling... Oh, brilliant. Sorry. The Titans of Wrestling are...
Pete, I'm a lead analyst for a show at Breakdown Matches.
Kelly, lead historian. I'm a jobber lover. Are you?
Johnny and I drink.
And yes, me, Bob. We watch old school wrestling and love it.
Titans of Wrestling.
You know you want to hear it.
Back with Scott Hudson talking memories of World Championship Wrestling, the syndicated shows, the classic Saturday 605 shows, call them B shows, call them C shows, but a ton of interesting and unique things would happen on those shows. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Scott, is you touched on the nature of how those shows were taped. And that a lot of times, you know, 3 months worth of television might be taped in a weekend, or especially, you know, at the Disney MGM studios, that would happen. It led to some interesting situations in if you're a wrestling historian like Graham Coffin is, it led to some interesting situations wherein a guy might lose a title on a show that was taped before he had won it on a live show. Speak to your experiences with that, maybe as a fan or maybe as a broadcaster, of times that you remember unique things like that you would see happening based on when they had to tape those shows.
Well, when I was with WCW, first off, I don't recall that happening when I was there, but I think they had gotten their act together a good bit by then. But before I went to work for WCW, living in Atlanta and writing for, you know, the Wrestling Observer and all the sheets and stuff, my friends and I would go all over the Southeast watching WCW television taping. So I saw more live WCW events before I went to work for the company than I did before I went to work there. And so we would see that kind of stuff happen where guys would show up, you know, in Dalton for a TV taping. And the first time he comes out, he doesn't have a belt. And the next time he comes out, he does. You know, we could put two and two together and realize that on Saturday night, a week from Saturday night, he's going to win the television title. So that was kind of easy to put together. But the one that everybody remembers, and I'll defer to you guys for the details, but the Freebirds won the tag team championships. Remember if it were the U.S. tags or whatever it was. I think they lost them before they won them. And they lost them at a TV taping in Orlando before they actually won the titles on a Clash or something like that a couple of weeks later.
Graham, jump in here and educate anybody who may have never heard this story before. It's one of my favorites ever.
Well, in February of 91, the Freebirds are going to challenge Doom for the titles at WrestleWar in Phoenix. Unfortunately, they... And without any real explanation, they walk into a taping maybe a few days before, maybe a week beforehand, with the belts and lose them to the Steiners. And then a few days later, win them from Doom, with the taped match then airing shortly thereafter. So they lost the belts on TV for a taping before they won them on live television.
Scott, do you think the syndicated shows were hurt some when you could no longer get away with cool stuff like that, like when information became a little more prevalent and it wasn't just a few people reading the Observer, it was people on the internet and things like that? Do you think that hurt the syndicated shows in a big way because you had to tape them so far in advance? It to some extent kind of made them forced to be obsolete at that point?
Well, yes, absolutely yes. But the reason why they did it, I think, is worth more of an exploration, and it was all money. And that if you could tape the show or record the show or whatever, however you described it, and in one city or in one locality, if you could do it in Atlanta and then tape in, you know, Forsyth, Marietta, Jonesboro, and Covington, but it's all local, it'd be easier to do that because you could afford to do a new taping every week without having to do so much craziness like what we just talked about with the Birds. But when it became no longer a regional territorial business and it became everybody wanted to break in and be national because of Vince's national expansion in the mid-'80s and then Crockett's about the same time, actually, but to a lesser degree until the late-'80s, you couldn't do that. You no longer could be a regional promotion. And as much as WCW tried in the late 80s and early 90s to be a southeastern regional promotion with pay-per-views in major cities nationwide, it just wasn't going to work. And even when they tried to do it, they realized that it was a fallacy, and then you end up with stuff like what happened to the Freebirds.
There, and this is a little bit earlier, but it kind of it speaks to the taping schedule, but it also speaks to Eric Bischoff. Here lately, I was watching. I don't know if it was a worldwide or a main event. It was something that he was co-hosting, and it was a secondary show. And the entire show, they are hyping up the main event as Sting and Hogan against the Bruise Brothers. And I'm thinking, this is weird, because I think the Bruise Brothers weren't even in the company, and maybe they did like one or two shots for WCW. They were working ECW at the time. They were, and in fact, at the point when this aired, they were working for the WWF, which ties into the story. So they hype up this match the whole time. The entire hour, Eric Bischoff is kind of saying, you know, they have no chance. Hogan and Sting are going to kill them, blah, 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 blah. And then the match happens. And Hogan and Sting killed them in about 30 seconds. If you look at the timing as to when this match aired, it was about 2 weeks before WrestleMania, and they were on the card. So it was one of those, we beat those guys so badly that they left the company. What's also interesting about this match is this was not the first time it had aired. It aired originally about 6 months earlier, which means it was taped probably about 9 months earlier.
Correct.
And they threw it in there.
And I don't know this. My gut feeling would be that the second airing, the one that buried them before the WrestleMania appearance, was probably heavily edited, that it may have been like a 10 or 12 minute match and they cut it.
No. It was, I mean, the original match when it aired was only about 30 seconds. I just thought it was funny that they thought it was worthwhile enough to dig up this match just because these guys were now working for the rival company and put it out there and hype it up for an hour with these guys that, you know, they only worked that one match for the entire company. They showed up at Disney. They did that spot with Hogan and Sting, and then they left.
Well, I stand corrected. WCW wasn't nearly as vitriolic as I thought they were, because I thought they would have taken an 8 minute match and cut it down to 20 seconds. So they just went out and buried him to begin with. You know, they obviously ended up coming back. So there was no hard feelings.
Well, they were also working with Hogan and Sting. So I mean, I'm sure they could be doing worse.
They would do that sometimes. You would see, like, Flair. I remember the Clash of the Champions where Flair and Sting beat the Colossal Kongs in, like, a minute. They were kind of protective of that idea of the tippy-top guys forming a super team. They definitely were kind of protective of that. Scott, I know it's been a long time ago, so I don't want to put you too much on the spot here, but what, if anything, stands out to you from all the matches that you've watched or called as part of being part of this legacy of these secondary shows? As what do you remember being as the most random, the most out of the blue things that you recall seeing? Maybe, you know, like the Barry Darso golfer gimmick or what have you, the things that stand out in you to you, your memories as being the most kind of random, out of the blue, unexpected things that happened on those shows where you kind of had the freedom to do stuff like that. It wasn't as tightly scrutinized as Nitro.
Well, the first thing, there's two things that jump out at me. One from Saturday night, and Graham may have seen this recently in his viewings, but we had Chris Adams, gentleman Chris Adams, on Saturday night for a good run, and he would come in. He still looked terrific. He could still work, but he did an angle basically with himself where he came out and kept losing, and he would lose to Robbie Rage, he would lose to, Devin Storm. He would lose to guys that may get pushed against lesser talent, but were really used to feed to the more established names like him, but he would lose. And every time that happened, he would just sit in the ring and just say, "What's happening to me? What's wrong with me?" And I remember thinking, like, where is this going? What are they going to do? And it ended up going nowhere. And it was really a cool angle. It was like, what are they going to do? They're going to turn him – obviously, they're going to turn him heel because he was a babyface, but are they going to have him come out as, like Berlin, or is he going to change his whole look and all that? And I don't remember what it was that convinced them to stop, although since it was Chris Adams, you can probably narrow it down to 5 or 10 good guesses. But it was a really weird thing that he would just sit in the ring and just get pissed at himself. What is wrong with me? Why can't I? And that was the most random thing on Saturday night, other than, Duggan stealing the belt out or taking the belt out of the trash and Barry with the hole-in-one gimmick. But we also did a thing on Worldwide where, I don't know what led up to this, but somebody got the wild idea to go out and find my audition tape and Mike Tenay's audition tape. And we did a whole segment on the Worldwide show where we were doing it from the TBS studios, the same studios over there on Techwood where Saturday Night was taped all those years. And we just basically watched each other's audition tape and cut promos on each other about how bad our audition tape was.
That's amazing.
Really?
That was really strange. I think that was on YouTube, actually.
If it is, we're going to post it with this show if we can find it, because that's amazing.
Yep.
Who, you know, when you were talking about like voiceover days and things like that, to the best of your recollection, kind of run us through the day or the schedule as best you can remember it. You know, we would show up and do, you know, 8 shows in 2 days, and you know, okay, this person was kind of in charge of directing and or, you know, right, kind of talk us through that.
All right, here we go. This might take a few minutes, but I'll tell you the whole story. Or the whole rundown. First, in context, I am a loyal employee of the federal government. I work for all of your listeners, work for you two guys. I'm a public servant. So I have a real full-time job that I've been to, you know, 100 years of college and done all sorts of stuff. And I've been doing this for, good grief, almost 30 years that I've been doing this line of work. So I did wrestling as a side job, as a hobby. So keep that in mind. So Sunday, if there's a pay-per-view week, I'm going to pick a city. I'm going to Pittsburgh to do a pay-per-view that night. Leave at 6 o'clock in the morning, get to Pittsburgh, go through the production meeting at 10 o'clock in the morning, go through pre-tapes all afternoon, do some homework for the matches, watch tapes to make sure we knew what the angles are, and then we do the pay-per-view, and the pay-per-view ends at whatever, 11 o'clock. Jump in a rental car, drive to Buffalo. Get to Buffalo at whatever, 1 o'clock in the morning, find the hotel, sleep as much as I can, get to the building for Nitro. I took Monday off from work, get to the building for Nitro at 10, production meeting, pre-tapes, homework, watching tapes, do Nitro. Nitro's over at 11, grab some sleep, get up at 5 o'clock, catch the first flight out, and land in Atlanta at 8 o'clock in the morning. Get to my office and work all day. Wednesday, get to my office and I'm home Tuesday night. Get to my office and work all day Wednesday. Wednesday night, after work, would go to the WCW studios over on Atlanta Road, just west of Atlanta, and we would record in studio and in some stand-ups in front of a set and definitely in the studio voiceover, International Nitro, International Thunder, and International Worldwide. And then, and then we would also record Domestic Worldwide, which was on a set. We didn't do a whole lot of voiceovers for that. That was Wednesday. That ended at midnight or 1 in the morning. Go to work Thursday, work all day Thursday, Friday, work all day Friday, and then when work's over Friday, I would go back to the TBS studios and we would record WCW Saturday night, the stand-ups on the set, and then the voiceovers of the matches, and that ended about 9 o'clock. And then, you know, I was home Friday night and had Saturday to do nothing, and, you know, unless it was a pay-per-view Sunday, had Sunday to do nothing, and it started all over again on Monday.
So for
so
you,
how was
it
your
was
social life?
Yeah, I was going to ask that, too.
I am married to a saint. I have a wonderful, patient wife. I also have an incredibly smart and talented daughter who, you know, just tolerated me. And I remember saying to my wife back then, I said, there's going to come a day, and I'm going to look back at this and wonder how in the hell I managed to pull all of this off. And, you know, that's happened, hell, several times today.
So for you, it was a weekly grind. It wasn't an instance where, you know, like, for instance, Jesse Ventura, in some of his interviews, has talked about, you know, what a great gig he had, because he felt like he just popped in the studio and did voiceovers. You know, he would knock out 2 Saturday nights and be done for 28 days or whatever. For you, it was more of a weekly thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I won't get into the salary they paid me, but I was they paid me very well, but they paid Bobby Heenan 3 times more than me. And he only did, at that point, he only did Worldwide. And he and I did Worldwide together. And that was all Bobby did. And he made 3 times more than me, and I'm doing Worldwide, Nitro, pay-per-views, Saturday night, 3 international shows. You know, doing a day on the 900 number, writing an article a month for the magazine, writing an article a week for the website, and, you know, it was insane. So, yeah, Bobby had it made, Jesse had it made, Bisco had it made, but, you know, I'm not complaining. I knew my role when I went in, and I won't complain one iota. It was a blast. I'd do it all again.
So how much recreational drugs were you using at this point?
Zero. Did I mention that I work for the federal government?
How now?
They tend to frown on even jokes about that.
That's not everyone in the business, Graham. That's not everyone in the business.
No. I'm just thinking to survive.
None is the answer, but in hindsight, it might have helped. But as it were, I didn't need them. I got through it. But, at some point, when WCW went under, which is now, coming up on 14 years ago, I was 36 years old. So, I was still fairly young, and I went to, did work for TNA and had a blast with it. But when I turned 40 in 2004, then I realized, I've got a real job. I've got a great job. I've got a great wife. I've got a great kid. I've got a big old house. I got a nice office. I don't need this anymore. So I said, that's it. Let somebody else that wants to do that schedule I just went through. They want to do that, they can have it.
Yeah, well, you did your time. You put your time in and were certainly an asset to the business and added a lot to the shows that we've been talking about. In a lot of instances, I think, and guys, Dan and Graham chime in, a lot of times those syndicated shows in a lot of ways relied more on the host to be a narrator of sorts because they weren't as angle driven. So a lot of times you're catching people up on what happened Monday on Nitro, what happened Thursday on Thunder, in addition to trying to sell what it is your job is to sell for Saturday night, whether it's Prince IKO
yet another Tough Tom Kenny Chaos match.
Yeah,
that's tough.
Well, I noticed, too, when I was watching Worldwide, I was watching a lot of Worldwides from January, and it was always like the aftermath of Starrcade, and we're trying to build up Sold Out. There was one year, of course, NWO basically ran Sold Out, and it was just really kind of funny to watch because every now and again you'd get little things that you were trying to put over and characters that, oh, okay, this is the future right here. This is a blue chipper. In fact, at one point in 1998, I wrote down in my notes that Bobby the Brain referred to Lorenzo as the I'm not joking. I you can find this. It's the Fabio of the new millennium, and I see big money with this Lorenzo character. So it's really, really funny to get that snapshot of a moment. And then 2 years later, I saw another show that featured Lorenzo, and Scott, you were on the call, and I don't know if you were seeing money in that kid the way Brain was a little bit earlier.
Oh, man, I remember Lorenzo. He was a nice-looking guy, and in all honesty, Bobby probably had it about right, except for the new millennium part. He was, the Fabio of that day, literally, that 24-hour period. But every time you see, and in all honesty, in full disclosure, my gut feeling is that Bobby knew this guy was a stiff and was just going over the top to try to, to crack up the people that knew the sport by putting him over so hard. It's kind of like when Randy Orton sold the Stone Cold Stunner several years ago, and he took two bumps in the ring, threw the ropes down to the floor, and took another bump on the floor from one stunner. I mean, it's like just so over-exaggerated selling just to entertain the crowd. That's probably kind of what Bobby was doing. Bobby was smart enough to know that Lorenzo was nothing, not going anywhere. But there's going to be a ton of people, and actually you've spurred my interest, or sparked my interest rather. I'm going to go back and look that stuff up. There's so many names that now just are gone that I guarantee I'm going to look back. Oh, I remember that guy. I can't wait to do that.
Who were your favorite guys to watch, Scott? Either as a fan or as an announcer, who did you always look forward to seeing their name on that piece of paper that I get to watch this guy's match or I get to call this guy's match?
Well, that's an easy one, but it's a longer list. But it starts with Eddie Guerrero, Chris Benoit, Dean Malenko, Ray Jr., Juventud. Any of the Lucha guys, those guys would just take your breath away, and you really want to get a workout, sit in a chair and try to call what they're doing. They're doing 20 moves in 4 seconds, and you've got to keep up with all of them, remembering what the name is and how they transition, and that will give you a mental and physical workout. So those guys, I really enjoyed calling their matches. I mean, no offense to you know, the late great John Tenta, but when the Shark's in the ring, you know, you're not going to have to be, you know, opening up your Mike Tenay book of professional wrestling holes or your, you know, Chris Benoit 1,002 wrestling holes sheet to figure out what's going on. It's not going to be that challenging of a call. But any of those guys, the Radicals, I guess, you can put Shane Douglas in there too, but those guys and the Lucha guys just really gave us a workout when they were in the ring, and I always adored calling anything they were in.
What, if anything, do you think maybe was a missed opportunity? You know, we touched on a little bit about, like, Jimmy Hart's vision for those syndicated shows kind of having their own little universe. Do you think that could have been done feasibly, or do you think they pretty much were handled about as well as they could be given the logistics of things? Or were there missed opportunities?
I think you got it right on the second one. I think that they handled it as well as they could have. Other than putting a Saturday night match on every pay-per-view, which they were never going to do, it would be almost like a brand extension. Remember those Halcyon days when SmackDown and Raw were two separate brands and they had the draft and all that stuff? It was almost like Saturday night should have felt a little more like that, but then they would have had to pull the trigger on at least one more step, and that's giving them a match, you know, on the pay-per-view. Or maybe every Nitro had a WCW Saturday night feature match, and it was only the guys you saw on Saturday, but they were never going to go that far because it was just, you know, forget quarter-hour breakdowns. It was like minute breakdowns on Nitro. We knew what, you know, what minute was working and what minute wasn't. Forget, you know, what match it was. It was what move and what match didn't work. And you know, they were never going to take the chance on something like that.
Well, we absolutely want to thank Scott Hudson for being with us tonight. A great talk, a great discussion of some days gone by. We want to encourage everyone in the sound of our voice to go back and look up some of these old match results. Look on YouTube. Look for anything from this era because, as we can all attest, there's a lot of fun matches. There's a lot of neat, interesting characters, whether it's, you know, Chris Benoit and Eddie Guerrero and Ray Jr. that you love, or if it's Bunkhouse Buck and Scott Armstrong, or if it's Masahiro Chono, whoever it is that you love, go back, get on YouTube, dig deep, and find some of these matches and relive them. Or if you're a reader, you could pick up Graham Cawthon's History of Wrestling books that details all of those results. And, Graham, where can they get those books?
Well, they can get those. That's a very good question. They can get those books in many ways. They can visit thehistoryofwwe.com, and there are links right there. They can go to amazon.com. They can go to barnesandnoble.com. And speaking of one book in particular, the WCW book that I put out last year, really hits that time frame of when Worldwide moved to Disney, and you would get to see, you know, Regal come out with the TV title 2 months before he won it, or Rick Rude come out with the International World title or the NWA World title 2 months before he won it. So it really hits on this time frame that we're talking about to a T.
Scott, thank you so much for joining us. Any parting words before we let you go? Obviously, would love to have you back anytime. It's a fun era in wrestling to talk about.
Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. It is always an honor to spend any time with Graham Cawthon and you guys as well. Now, I'm just grateful that anybody even remembers that time frame. It seems like, you know, with every passing day, with every, you know, every Raw that John Cena's less and less over, that people forget that there actually was a WCW. And, you know, if they remember that, they forget that there was a Saturday night. And I'm all in favor of revisiting those days and those shows. They were worth our time, and they're worth our time now.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Scott. We will be right back with our picks of the week and your questions from Twitter.
What's going on? This is the Godfather, Nate Milton, with an offer you cannot refuse. Each and every week, join Marcus Vandenberg and myself for the world's most dangerous sports show and the program that's changing the game one show at a time, the Kings of Sport Podcast. Available exclusively on PlaceToBeNation.com, your one-stop spot for the best in sports and pop culture.
Hey, sports fans, this is Dr. G for Extra Point, Place to Be Nation's traditional sports talk podcast. Every episode, Scott Criscullo and I talk everything from the Big Four leagues to all the hot sports news with exclusive guests and analysts. Email us your comments and questions at extrapoint@placetobenation.com. That's the Extra Point, exclusively on placetobenation.com.
Hey, sports fans, Cowboy here. Make sure you make your weekly stop by the Sports Lounge here on placetobenation.com, where the boys and I tackle all the hot topics in the world of sports. We go behind the numbers and provide in-depth expert analysis on Major League Baseball, MMA, NFL, and more. The seats fill up quick, so grab your favorite cigar, kick back, and join us in the Sports Lounge, only on placetobenation.com.
In Rhode Island and looking for great food and a fun atmosphere, we'll be sure to stop by Bonehead's Wing Bar, 131 Washington Street in West Warwick, with over 65 different wing sauces and dozens of sandwiches, burgers, and appetizers. In a fully stocked bar, Bonehead's has something for everyone. Boneheads also shows every WWE and UFC pay-per-view, features live music, weekly trivia, and much, much more. So, be sure to stop in, tell Matt and the crew that Place to Be Nation sent you, and become a Bonehead today.
Hey, this is Rob Naylor. Do you still enjoy pro wrestling? Believe it or not, I still do. So you better join myself and Will on the Google Wrestling Podcast exclusively at PlaceToBeNation.com.
Shit, I wasn't ready. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening and shit. Hey, this is Will. If you like listening to guys talk about old school wrestling, follow me and Charles on Wrestling with the Past podcast on Place to Be Nation.
What's up, wrestling fans? This is Jeff Peck, and you can check out my wrestling podcast, The Still Real to Us Show, every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com. It is a wrestling podcast from a fan's perspective. And we're not doing it in our mom's basement. So check it out every Saturday right here at PlaceToBeNation.com.
It's still real to me, damn it!
Looking for new wrestling, sports, and pop culture voices? Head over to PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. We have an extremely talented staff that covers comics, video games, and all facets of entertainment. Our sports coverage spans all the major professional and collegiate sports, including MMA. Our fresh takes on professional wrestling are some of the best on the internet. Also, be sure to check out our friends at thehistoryofwwe.com, prowrestlingonly.com, Scott Keith blog at rspwfaq.net, and piledriverwrestling.net.
WCW Pro, WCW Saturday Night. We encourage all of you to go back and check out some of those shows. Let us know your favorite matches or memories or whatever. And Dan, I understand some people have already done that, have contacted us and brought up some stuff for us to talk about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The Twitter was blowing up for our show. And in fact, we're going to talk about this later. But if you want to contact our show in any way, shape, or form over the Twitter universe, it's hashtag HOW podcast. Or basically, if you capitalize the H and capitalize the W and capitalize the P, you get the idea. But we did get some feedback, and I think we're going to read it off during this segment. Right, guys?
Absolutely. That is correct.
Hit us up with it.
All right.
Oh, we want to go ahead and do this now. We can do this now.
This is what you're talking about during the break. Brad just goes and does his own
Brad
thing.
Brad just wants to do what he's like. Screw the format. We're going to start with the last thing first.
I can't be restricted by a format, man. I'm a freewheeling, open-minded, sexually ambiguous dude. I can't be conforming to your ideals of what I should be or what the show should be.
Okay, how do you and Grant Sawyer get along?
Because he handles. Here's exactly how me and Grant Sawyer get along, is he does the opposite. I just do whatever, and then he makes it make sense and makes a format out of my madness.
Okay,
rather
well,
than
here,
having me adhere to his structure. He structures
gotcha.
My chaos.
Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make an executive decision,
And that is, we are not going to do the Twitter right now. We're going to do the card of the week. Who's got the card of the week?
I have the card of the week.
Looks like you would, considering the card that I'm looking at.
Yeah, I went late 90s. There are plenty of great cards for Worldwide, Saturday Night, Main Event, whatever you want to do. I went with this card because, actually, it was a funny story that also involves our guest today, Scott Hudson. So he talked about how Saturday night tapings generally were like weeks and weeks upon end of programming that they would just record. And this was from Rome, Georgia, of course, December 1st, 1998. This is basically like 20-some-odd matches, many of which kind of just demonstrate the number of names that made you think that I made the point earlier. Are you still employed in this company? And this is 98, so you have your Glaciers and your Disco Infernos and your...
No. You are going to read this thing word for word. A book's length.
Oh,
yes.
My goodness. So
this is amazing.
As I read off these results, think to yourself...
It's like the roster for World War III.
Think 1998, and did you honestly think this guy was still drawing a check at this point in time in WCW? So here we go. Glacier defeated Barry Horowitz. Yeah, I bet he was patting himself on the back all the way down to the ring. We got Chip Minton defeating Chris Adams, Gentleman Chris Adams. We got Disco Inferno defeating the Silver King. We have Hole-in-One Barry Darso defeating Tokyo Magnum. Remember that? Remember him, guys? Eh?
Yep.
Eh? Here's a big one, actually. This was kind of out of nowhere. Chris Benoit and Dean Malenko teamed up to defeat the team of Steve and Scott Armstrong.
Let me see.
Yeah. We got Scott Putski defeating Bobby Blaze. Meng defeating Sergeant Buddy Lee Parker. Canyon, who better than Canyon, defeated Kaz Hayashi. We got Scott Steiner defeating Lash LaRue. Lash LaRue came up a number of times when I was watching late 90s B shows. Let's see. Scott Hall defeated Booker T via disqualification. We got Taru defeating Kendall Windham. Did you realize Kendall Windham was still employed at this day and age at WCW, guys? I'm sure you guys did.
He was getting ready for that push, man. He was getting ready for that rap gimmick.
That phone could ring at any time. Bobby Duncan Jr., classic, defeating Vincent.
Classic.
Not often NWO went, did the job, but here we do, right there.
It's Vincent.
Prince Iaukea.
Here's the thing. I bet after Duncan beat him, Vincent charged him $20.
For a picture in the subway. Yep. Prince Iaukea defeated Johnny Swinger, if you like Johnny Swinger. Chavo Guerrero Jr. versus Lenny Lane. I got to talk about this briefly. You can find this on YouTube. It's not our YouTube clip of the week. This actually, it's a misprint. Chavo Jr., I guess, technically got the win, but really the match that was put on display was Lenny Lane came out with a microphone and said that he's a very underutilized talent in the cruiserweight division. And he actually went and challenged Pepe, the little hobby horse, the little horse on a stick that Chavo would carry around. And there are moments in this match, guys, where Chavo would be disabled and knocked to the floor, and Lenny would actually, Double L would actually start kicking and stomping on Pepe. So, and you know who was on the call for that match was Scott Hudson. True.
Oh, we should have asked him about that. I'm sure he would remember it.
Oh, I mean, how can you forget Pepe versus Lenny Lane?
Or after remembering it, he would have post-traumatic stress.
Oh, gosh. Poor Lenny. He was. I mean, if you're not going over on a toy horse, that pretty much says it all about your career, right? Because he lost the match. I'm spoiler alert right there.
I don't know. I mean, if you can lose to a toy horse and get yourself over, you're the champion. You should be the world champion.
Moving on, Norman Smiley defeated Viano 5, not to be confused with 1 through 4. That's number 5. Kaz Hayashi pulling double duty. He fought Ernest Miller to no contest. Conan, representing the New World Order, defeated Mike Enos. And this is a double main event, if you will. WCW Cruiserweight Champion Billy Kidman teamed with Rey Mysterio Jr. to defeat Eddie Guerrero and Juventud Guerrera. So there's a gem in this lot. And then finally, Scott Hall defeated Stevie Ray. That is the entire taping, Saturday night taping from December 1st, 1998, probably covered several shows in the process. And that just really kind of is a nice snapshot of what we were looking at with these B shows in the late 90s, when everybody else was talking about NWO and Sting and Goldberg and all these other, you wouldn't necessarily see some of these cats on the big shows, but you would see them on Saturday night week after week during those late 90s into 1999 and into 2000.
That's right. This week's YouTube link of the week is something that I dug up. It's actually from the town in which I live right now, Shelby, North Carolina. And this is technically – okay, it's from Worldwide. But it's from Worldwide, and I want to make this distinction clear. I'm glad we did this earlier in the show. Worldwide used to be the show, and much of what we talked about today, we focused on when it wasn't the show. But I wanted to throw this clip out there to show the contrast between what it became and what it once was. And this link is this clip is from July 1985, and I'm sure. Historians who are listening already know, based off of my clues, what this match is. This is the Rock and Roll Express against the Russians for the NWA World Tag Team titles. It's the first night in the company for Ricky and Robert, and they go about a half an hour with the Russians, and they win the titles. And that is a hot crowd, and it kind of speaks to what Scott and we were talking about earlier about when they would have Worldwide in the gyms or the high school gyms or the smaller arenas and how hot that crowd was. And so when you guys take a look at this, compare this to what Worldwide later was with the Disney crowd, the tourist crowd, the crowd that probably – you know, didn't know who three-fourths of the guys were if they weren't Hogan or Savage. And you'll see a strong contrast there.
Yeah, absolutely. WWE Network Pick of the Week is another example of that contrast. Watch it soon because it's in the Black History Month section. It's the syndicated show on which Ron Simmons wins the WCW Championship from Vader, a big historical event, but watch the whole show because, once again, it's a snapshot of what those shows represent in the sense that in a one-hour card you would get Jushin Thunder Liger against Jimmy Jam Garvin. You would get a guy like Barry Windham, a guy like Doc and Gordy, someone like Matt Bourne as Big Josh. In the span of 1 hour, you get modern guys, new faces, familiar stars from the 80s, and in the instance of this particular show, you get a major historical event. Not a lot of those secondary WCW shows are represented on the network, but we lucked out in that one being uploaded. Check it out before they take it down, because it's a very, very cool piece of history all the way around, not just that one match.
And I got to say here, I think that's a great pick for many reasons. One of the reasons is, as you guys may know, I'm working on a book right now on the history of the Baltimore Arena. That title change where Ron Simmons beats Vader to become the first black world champion was at the Baltimore Arena. And this week, I have probably conducted about 10 to 12 interviews with fans, longtime Baltimore wrestling fans, many of whom were there that night, and it's just really interesting to hear their take on how historic that was, but also this was kind of a down period for WCW. This was a down period for wrestling. You know, some folks who were at, say, the match where Tito Santana in Baltimore beat Greg Valentine in the cage for the IC title. I talked with one guy today who was at both of those events, and said that honestly, Tito winning the title was probably a bigger pop for a historical standpoint, for a socioeconomic or whatever, racial. Ron Simmons winning the title was a bigger thing, but it was a sold out crowd for Tito and Valentine. And by '92, for as much I think a lot of us look at 92 and WCW and love it, but it was not good for business. And so that was a much smaller crowd. But it was just interesting to hear those different perspectives as to how big a deal that was being in that crowd. And, you know, Brad, I think you especially have come across this guy more than I have, but I remember a few months ago, the quote unquote crying Ron Simmons fan passed us in Charlotte.
Absolutely. And always, that's always who I look for on that Ron Simmons power slam, is the kid running down to the front row, jumping up and down, losing his mind at seeing Ron Simmons become the first black heavyweight champion. It's a neat card to watch. It's a neat show to watch, I should say, particularly for that historical moment, but also it gives you a good glimpse into what B show life or C show life was like in the early 90s.
So, and, guys, now do you want to do Twitter, or did you?
Yes, we can do Twitter now.
Yeah. Okay, I'll start because it starts off with a little bit of love, and of course we are, you know, we're three guys, but we also kind of like to be appreciated. And a couple of our initial Twitter followers decided to give us that love, and we're going to start with @bushbum16. He writes, "Yep, definitely love the at history of WWE podcast on @placetobenation, and of course he uses the hashtag of HOW podcast. And then a fan that probably will be listening to this show, knowing what the subject matter is, @WCW Lion writes, @thehistoryofWWE, found the HOW podcast today. I'm not sure when he did this, but he did find it, and it sounds very interesting. I will listen to it next week." So he is listening right now, and we are reading his tweet. And if you want to tweet us with that love, we will take it on and appreciate it and read it on the air for you. And Brad, I think there was a competing podcast Twitter handle that sent their suggestions for some great matches that they've seen on some BNC shows. Why don't you take that one?
I don't have that one.
Oh, did I say Brad? I meant Graham.
Ah. You're drunk. Okay.
See, this is why we can't have a format, guys. This is why we need to be free-flowing like wine and not adhering to Graham's tight structures.
You guys listening can't tell this, but we essentially have the 2001 WCW technical crew working for us, and so we're getting miscues. Things are like pieces of electronics are falling down behind us. We're cutting to commercial too late, so random people are walking down the hallway during the camera shot that shouldn't be. It's a mess.
Just fell down behind me.
I'll fuck it. So we've got @BigBoysPlayWCW, who I think this was in response to, I was asking folks what are some hidden gems from some of these shows, and that account said the Windham and Pillman series of 1991, Flair versus Pillman in 90 and 91, and Disorderly Conduct. And I don't disagree with any of that, but I think this kind of speaks to when these shows were more emphasized than when they weren't. And I think during the 90 and 91, worldwide especially, was still a heavily pushed product. I think for the majority of what we've been talking about today, we were focusing more on the late 90s when it really, you know, why is it still on the air? And then our last feedback for this week is from @EddieJ1984, and this is in response to another podcast of ours. "Did the optimism only last 1 week, guys? Hopefully the NXT special pumped you guys up to do another episode. I think that's a great idea." Well, we will save that for another episode.
Sounds like a plan to me, guys. Thank you very much for listening to us. Dan, if this is someone's first time listening, tell them where they can find us.
Well, they can find us in any number of ways, and I will tell you all about them right now. You can find the History of Wrestling podcast by visiting placetobenation.com and clicking on the PTBN podcast banner on the right-hand side. In addition, just by subscribing to the Place to Be podcast feed on iTunes, you will automatically receive the latest episodes of the History of Wrestling podcast. You can visit our friends at Stitcher.com and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast, or download the Place to Be Nation podcast app by hitting up placetobe.podbean.com/mobile on your iPhone or iPad devices. Be sure to follow us on Twitter. It's at the History of WWE and at Place to Be Nation. And we'll give our Twitter handles out as well, at Stutzy, at DMACP2B, and of course at History of WWE. You can also like Place to Be Nation on Facebook at facebook.com/placetobenation. Finally, you don't have to be a lower mid-card guy like, I'm going to name a few, Johnny Boone or Bobby Walker, perhaps even a Mark LaRue or Rick Fuller. You, whoever you are, you can send us feedback by hitting us up on the Twitter by using that hashtag, HOWPodcast. Guys.
Super fun show. Super loaded show. And, yeah, maybe Graham's right. Maybe next time we will hit you with a little more optimism. Until then, tweet us. Keep watching wrestling. Let us know what you're optimistic about. Let us know what you love. Let us know your favorite matches, memories, or moments from the history of wrestling.